It's 9:27 and the board has returned from executive session. We'll do a swift roll call. Dr. King?
Present.
Dr. Bustillo?
Here.
Mr. Leone?
Here.
Dr. Hike?
Here.
Mr. Greer?
Here.
Mr. Barton is still absent, and board staff, Ms. Cardoza?
Present.
Ms. Crowley?
Here.
Ms. Richardson?
Present.
And I'm Judy Chepius. All are present. Dr. King, just a reminder, Dr. King and board members, there is a motion with a second on the table to open a complaint in against JB.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. So we have a motion and a second to open the complaint. I would like to amend the motion, if I could, to add as part of the investigation the potential violation of 32.2044.8. And I don't recall who seconded.
That was Dr. Bustillo.
I'll re-second.
Okay. Are there any other discussions or questions regarding the motion or the board?
One item. Can you describe the reg that you just entered in, so that it's on record in terms of the what that is? I'm not sure that JB would know what that is.
32.2044.8.
Yes.
Practicing as a physical therapist or working as a physical therapist assistant when physical or mental abilities are impaired by disease or trauma or by the use of controlled substances or other habit-forming drugs, chemicals, or alcohol, or by other causes.
Thank you.
All right. Are we ready to call a vote? And if so, Judy, do you mind please calling the vote?
It's been moved and seconded to open a complaint for possible violation of ARS 32.2044.8 and failure to timely disclose the charge. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Hike?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
That motion passes.
Thank you. JB, Mindy, the board investigator will get with you on next steps and detail.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. All right, board members, we are going to move back up to agenda item 9B, case number 2315, Timothy Fearon. And this is an initial review. I want to make sure that who's on needs to be on. Mr. Dr. Fearon, are you on the call? I see you. Okay, great.
For me?
Yes.
I'm here.
Perfect. Thank you. And complainant LW.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you. Before we get started, I'd like to just read some expectations around what an informal an initial review looks like, just to kind of level set for you, and then we will move into some details. So this is the time and the place scheduled for the board's initial review of complaints. There is one case for the board to consider today. The matters will be heard by the board pursuant of its authority, 32.2045. For everyone's benefit, I'll provide a brief summary of how the board handles an initial review. We first begin with introductions of the board members. My name is Dr. Kelly King, and I'm the board president, and I'll ask the other board members to introduce themselves.
Oh, you're muted, Dr. Bustillo.
Thank you. Karen Bustillo, professional member, vice president.
Giovanni Leone, professional member, secretary.
John Hyde, professional member.
Great, thank you. Josh, did you
introduce? Joshua Greer, public member.
Thanks, Josh. In each case, the board will first hear a brief summary of the investigative report from its staff. Once staff is completed, That report, the board will then ask the complainant if they wish to address the board, and then the board will ask the professional or their counsel, if they have counsel, if they would like to do the same. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask that speaking not take time to repeat information that the board has already received. You will be given the same amount of time to address the board that it took to present the investigative report, about 5 minutes or so, whichever is greater. Please keep in mind that this is not the time or the place for the complainant and the professional to address each other. Once the board concludes its discussion with the parties, it will move into deliberations. While the parties are free to stay and listen to the deliberations, we ask that you respect the fact that we are now discussing the case amongst ourselves and request that you not interrupt our process. The board's options include, but are not limited to, dismissing the complaint, taking non-disciplinary action such as issuing an advisory letter or an order of continuing education, offering the professional a consent agreement, requesting the professional participate in an informal hearing, or remanding the matter to a formal hearing. Before we call the first case, I want to advise everyone that the initial reviews are audio recorded. Accordingly, it's important that everyone speak loudly and clearly, and only one person speak at a time, please. And then lastly, as a reminder to us as the board, this is not an informal hearing. If you have a few questions that will help you better understand the case and the investigation that we've already received, to help resolve the case through dismissal, non-disciplinary, or consent agreement, please feel free to ask those. However, if you have a number of substantive questions and need additional investigative information, it may be more appropriate to move the case to an informal hearing. All right, that being said, we'll call the case 2315, Timothy Fearon. Mr. Fearon, you are present, and I know LW is. Mindy, would you like to give us a summary of your investigation, please?
Sure. In case 2315, LW states that during her first and only session with Dr. Fearon, he engaged in inappropriate statements and touching, which made her feel uncomfortable and unsafe. She canceled future visits and filed her complaint with the board the following day. This case is for your review.
Thank you. LW, would you like to make a statement to the board, please?
Yes. All right. I can think of a thousand things I'd rather be doing today instead of reliving the emotions of the experience, but I want to foremost give my gratitude to the Arizona State Board of Physical Therapy for having a system in place for complaints and for taking them seriously. On February 22nd, 2023, I walked into Fearon Physical Therapy for my initial appointment at 8:30 a.m. I've had chronic low back pain for over 2 years, and a trusted personal friend of mine who is also a woman and a practicing physical therapist suggested I look into getting an appointment with Dr. Fearon. She'd taken some of his workshops for her CE requirements and thought he may be able to help with my back issues, so I scheduled an appointment. I had a busy work day ahead of me and assumed this appointment would be straightforward, as previous physical therapy experiences have been for me. It turned out to be one of the most unprofessional and inappropriate experiences of my life from a medical professional. I felt incredibly uncomfortable doing and found it even more so upsetting after I'd processed what actually happened. Dr. Fearon's crude comments came out so casually that it caught me off guard, and I wondered how often he says these things. I reached back out to my friend later in the afternoon and let her know some of the strange things the PT said during the first appointment. She was appalled and strongly encouraged me to file a complaint, which leads us to today. I believe that this individual misused his position of power and neglected to practice ethical integrity. The next day, I explained to my therapist that I'd never been in this situation before and was very uncomfortable with the things he said and did during the appointment, and I was also disappointed in myself that I didn't call out his inappropriate behavior in the moment. She helped me to understand that my nervous system kicked in, and we don't always get to decide how we will react in that moment. It may be flight, fight, freeze, or fawn. I believe my nervous system went into a fawning mode where I was as polite as possible to get through the situation safely. It's a coping mechanism that minimizes distress in the face of a threat or trauma. Several days after this appointment, I wrote an honest Google review, encouraged by my husband to prevent other women from having to endure the same experience. I got a call from Dr. Fearon within 48 hours with an obligatory apology, as his wife notified him of the review. Needless to say, I haven't sought out another physical therapist yet, but I hope the outcome of this meeting will help prevent any inappropriate behavior and uncomfortable situations while keeping Dr. Fearon accountable of his actions. Going to physical therapy shouldn't be traumatic. It should feel safe, and clients shouldn't have to wonder if a doctor has their best interest in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Fearon, would you like to make an opening statement or a statement to the board?
Yes, I would. Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for what you do. Not only is this my profession, not only is it my livelihood, it is my life. I don't know how many of you know, my reputation doesn't matter. Rather than that, the contribution, the things that I've done in the profession over the course of the last 45 years. I'm currently and have been for 37 years in a PT business. That's a service industry with my wife, right? That is dependent completely upon actually delivering a service, right? It's got to be a superior service. Otherwise, you're out of business. Happens that because of my interest in spine, what I've developed is a higher level capacity for spine patients. And subsequently, I see referrals from other PTs, from other practitioners, people who have had failed episodes. In fact, LW is one such patient. So she fit right into the pattern of things that I usually see. There's two things that I have to look at. Number one is physiologic, and the other is psychologic. And I really totally missed the psychological impact that was happening with my patient in front of me because I was so over-focused on the physiologic problem. And the lack of being able to get her to be able to do that which I wanted, which was to create movement between L5 and S1. That's where her symptoms were. That's the place that I generated those symptoms. And what I needed to get her to be able to do was to create motion there in addition to the hip. It's my bias to try and get patients to be independent as quickly as possible. So I bias towards doing something that's physical, that's active exercise, therefore not dependent upon me being there, particularly because I knew she was coming from across the valley. So that is what I did. And I'm in the failure to get there. You know, I'm intense. I'm very focused. It's why I succeed to failed. And I was looking for whatever language I could in order to get her to actually generate pelvic movement, lumbopelvic at the lumbosacral junction, not just abdominal tightening. And, you know, I use language that it was very clear, it was offensive to her. When I looked at it in standalone sentences, I found it offensive. I'm sure that what it was a role of conversation for me shopping verbally for what might be effective. So I fell into something I teach my students not to, and that is a recency bias. I had a recent run of patients who did best when I was very vigorous in my admonishing them about what they should do, and I started into doing that with somebody who I felt quasi-familiar with just because one of her friends had been a student, and I used language I just shouldn't have. I guess that's my opening statement. Since that time, I've watched myself. When you do something for 4 decades, you start to do certain things, you do them routinely. I routinely tell patients what I'm going to do. What I didn't routinely do was to start off, because I am a fellow in the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Usually I see people who have never seen a legitimate manual therapist. So what I do now, what I thought was, errantly thought was understood when anybody walked in the door, is that that's what they were coming to, a manual therapy examination. So since this day, what I do now, what I initially thought was an overstatement, I tell them this is going to be the most thorough examination you've ever been through. Manual examination. I'm going to watch you move. I'm going to feel how you move. I'm going to see whether or not we can provoke your symptoms. And I do that routinely as an announcement before we start, and that's completely because of what happened on that particular day. So tell them if it bothers them in any way, I'd like to know. And, oddly enough, I owe LW a bit of gratitude because the other people who may walk in the door that would have the same response to the same behavior. I don't know them. I won't know until, and hopefully I never meet that again because of the announcement.
Thank you, Dr. Fearon. At this time, board members, do you have any questions for LW or for Dr. Fearon?
I do for LW in terms of the written statement suggests that Dr. Fearon did not ask for consent at the very beginning. Can you walk us through that, what his explanation was in terms of starting at the hip and strapping down your pelvis in terms of trying to get motion from your perspective?
Sure. I guess when I go to a physical therapist, I'm used to them saying, okay, next what we're going to do is you're going to lay on the table. I'm going to do this exercise. I'm going to touch you here. And that didn't happen. It was just, hey, lay on the table. And then as he was strapping me down, he said, hey, this is kind of kinky. And I was like, that's weird. I just don't think that's appropriate. And in the moment, I was just kind of caught off guard. You know, I tried to do what he was asking. I just thought it was a very strange way to communicate something that could be very straightforward and very professional. And I didn't get a lot of consent, or he didn't let me know what he was doing. He would just touch my hips or strap or whatever it was. And I it didn't feel right.
So you, if I understand it correctly, then he didn't provide any explanation at the beginning as he was describing what he would be doing in terms of his evaluation. Is that correct?
He let me know that he would be evaluating my movements. I just wasn't expecting the commentary the way that it was presented. And I've gone to physical therapy quite often, and I've always been told, like, hey, what I'm going to do next is this, 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 and that just didn't happen.
And then in terms of whether he was touching your back or touching your hips, did you hear what was the explanation for that?
I knew when it was appropriate, when he was actually evaluating the motion, the range of motion. Mm-hmm. And then I knew when the touch was lingering longer or in a spot that it didn't need to be. And so for me, having been to multiple physical therapists and male physical therapists, I knew a standard of professionalism, and this didn't feel professional. And so did I answer that question properly?
Yes. My next question then, Dr. Fearon, in terms of your explanation and your written response, is there anything that you'd like to add?
The only thing I would add to that is that what she's talking about with the stabilization belt is, of course, going on to treatment. It's no longer really assessment. At that point, what we decided was that the hip wasn't moving well enough, and I needed the pelvis to stay stationary and to add the traction component to the hip. It's a little odd, and I had a patient recently, a woman who said to me, is this the kinky part where the old guy straps down the woman? We both thought it was funny, and it was clearly not at all funny at this moment, but there's no question that I explained that the pelvis was to be stationary, and that was the reason for the strap.
So in terms of your evaluation and where your hands were on her, whether that's anterior or posterior or the lumbar spine, did you feel that you provided adequate consent and explanation to her, to LW?
I have to rely on what has always been a habitual pattern. I start in with something. This is what I'm going to do. This is what should happen. If it's different than that, particularly if it's a pain provocation thing, then I would like you to let me know. In the pain provocation, you're shopping for the symptoms. And so the communication is ongoing. Did we stop at every moment and say, okay, now here's the next phase? No, I start into the movement and I tell the patient exactly what it is I'm going to be doing.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Farron, I have a question, please, regarding a statement that you made a bit ago that a patient had made a comment to you about something being kinky. And it makes me wonder if you understand the difference in the power differential between a patient saying that to you versus you saying something like that to a patient.
I do now. With that particular patient who I have seen since that time, she basically brings it up and says that. And that isn't a universally funny statement. And I've learned that now.
Dr. Farron, there are three statements that are attributed to you. The first statement is this quote, "It's a bit kinky for an old guy to be strapping a young woman to the table." Do you admit that you made that statement?
I do. I said that. I remember it because I was thinking it was a quote from the former patient I just met. And a little apt.
Mr. Greer, can you please repeat that question so we can have it on the record?
Yeah, the second statement that is attributed to you is, quote, "Tilt your pelvic bone so high I can smell it." Is that a statement you made?
I do not remember saying that. What I do remember is that she was failing to generate the movement, and I was going through I commonly use the nose as an orientation. I believe at that point in time we were standing, and I asked her to bring her pubic bone up towards her nose. And because I was standing in front and nothing was happening, I'm certain that I said, "No, bring it towards my nose." I don't remember having said the statement about smelling. But I was going through a rapid fire worth of shopping for what might work, what will make her actually transfer my verbiage into physical function.
Do you recall the patient remarking about how that was an awkward statement?
I do recall her saying that. I don't remember exactly at what point she said that. Yeah, that's a true thing.
And then the last statement was, quote, "Tighten your ass muscle so hard that if I grab it, it will hurt my hand." Is that a statement that you made?
That's a statement that I probably made. There was no grabbing involved, though. I wanted to get gluteal contraction. That was the focus, and it wasn't happening. I have no idea if I had not educated her well, or if she just had lost proprioceptive sense of it, kinesthetic awareness for the duration of time she had wrong, but it wasn't occurring. And I knew very well that that wasn't going to change the lumbar sacral junction unless we actually accomplished it.
I appreciate it. Thank you for your answers. Mm-hmm.
I have a question for LW, that if the person that referred you to Dr. Farron was a previous student of Dr. Farron's, if I'm understanding that correctly, did she prep you in any way that the evaluation might be different than anything that you've previously seen in physical therapy?
So from what I know, she's just taken a few workshops. So I don't know far as how long she was with
Fair enough.
But no, she didn't mention that. She did mention that he had developed a different therapy style. And yeah, so I've been to a lot of physical therapists. I'm not afraid of, you know, manually moving. It was more of the context and the things that were said that made me uncomfortable.
Great. Thank you very much.
LW, I think you said in your statement that you are a personal trainer or an athletic trainer and very familiar with different motions and anatomical pieces, right? So an anterior pelvic tilt or a posterior pelvic tilt, that's not a new, is that a new motion for you to try to understand?
No, I understand what that means.
Dr. Furon, has anything changed within your documentation since this incident in regards to documenting consent or, you know, how you're verbalizing what it is that you're doing with the patient?
Well, the verbalization has changed for me dramatically, in that before I let the patient do anything, I tell them this will probably be the most thorough examination you've ever been through. It's an orthopedic manual physical therapy exam. I'm going to watch you move. I'm going to feel you move. I'm going to look to see if I can provoke symptoms. And have I changed it in documentation? I document that the consent was obtained, but I don't. I obviously don't write down such verbiage.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any further questions for Dr. Furon or LW? Okay. And at this time, we'll conclude the interview and questions process of the initial review. We'll go into deliberations and again ask that there's no further interaction with the board while we discuss our thoughts. Okay. So board members, we have the allegation 32-2044-12. What are your thoughts after reading all the information and hearing from Dr. Furon and LW?
I said initial thought, I am super grateful that the patient has had positive experiences with physical therapists so that she recognized when something was a little off. I'm grateful for the prior therapist that's treated her and her friend who told her, hey, this is not the standard and this is not what you should expect. And I'm super grateful for those unnamed prior treating therapists and their integrity and ethics. I think, you know, everyone now knows what happened on that day in February shouldn't have happened that way. I don't really know where to go from here with that, but, you know, I know this has been a learning experience for everyone, but, you know, the statements that were made, I think in hindsight, the doctor realizes that, oh, I shouldn't have said it that way. I'm grateful for that recognition. I still think there's probably some more room for improvement, and I would recommend some kind of non-disciplinary continuing education in the area of boundaries and that physician-patient power dynamic. I don't know how to craft a good course for that, but those are my initial thoughts.
That's where I was going with it as well. You know, I appreciate Dr. Furon, you know, specifying that he's learned from this incident and that he's trying to change up the way that he, you know, looks for consent from patients and changing up verbiage and things of that nature. But, you know, I definitely don't feel like that we should just leave it at that. I think that there, as Mr. Greer said, there's still some room for growth. So, I would definitely recommend the same thing. You know, something in regards to ethics, something in regards to the patient, clinician relationship, you know, the dynamics between them, something like that.
Yeah, I completely agree with both of you. In that, you know, reading the statements and listening to the interviews, I appreciate that Dr. Fionn's taking accountability for making these statements, but I think it's important that he continued to grow in that, because it felt like when I was listening to his statement that his understanding of her being so upset was because she potentially had a history of abuse. He's worked with psychologists and he works with patients with abuse, and not every female who reacts to comments like that has any history. And so I think that there's definitely some opportunity to grow in understanding the boundaries and the line between what's appropriate and not appropriate to say to any patient, regardless of their gender, and regardless of their psychological background. I know Karen's really struggling with her. It looks like she's having a hard time with her Wi-Fi where she's at today. So she's kind of been in and out. Karen, while we have you, do you have any thoughts?
I like where we're headed. Even though it's not incredibly well defined right this second, I do believe there has been a good amount of self reflection that's gone on by Dr. Fearon. I think that adding to that with some additional continuing education in the communication realm might be perfect. And so I would support that for sure.
Do you feel like something like along the lines of the PBI, you know, around boundaries, are we thinking, you know, something is like that?
I don't know what that is.
It's a Proby. It's a Proby.
Oh.
Course. They've got for professional boundaries.
That's going to be a disciplinary
mm-hmm.
a sanction.
The Proby is not a CEU? Oh,
no.
Thank you.
That's kind of the big deal.
Okay.
I'm definitely in favor of more of a non-disciplinary.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was a CEU course.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
So are you looking at like maybe ethics, you know, for like 3 hours or something that can be taken online? I don't know. Maybe Giovanni knows if there's a communication type, professional communication class. Not that you have to look it up, but.
I think Dr. Fearon, it'll be on his to work on that. Find those things and make sure they're approved to the board to meet their expectations. Right. I'll make a motion and we can go from there. I'll make a motion of offering a non-disciplinary consent agreement with CEUs.
Dr. King, let me interrupt you. Let's just order it. We don't need a consent agreement. We can just order non-disciplinary continuing education. We don't have to get them to agree to it.
Okay. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. So then go ahead, Josh.
Well, I need your help. I'm just pointing out where the doer's deeds could have been done better.
Okay. So not a consent agreement. Order that.
A board order
that Dr. Fearon complete. 3 hours of ethics. I would really like to have him find at least 6 hours of professional conduct, boundaries, communication. All can be completed online and 6 months to complete.
Greer, second.
Okay. Are there any other questions or thoughts or amendments suggested? Okay, so Mindy, do you want to summarize the motion and we can take a vote? Judy?
I'll let Judy do it. Hi, Judy.
It has been moved and seconded to issue a non-disciplinary board order for continuing education, which shall be completed within 6 months. The courses must be pre-approved and may be completed online. They do not count towards renewal requirements. The continuing education must be completed in the areas of ethics for a minimum of 3 hours and boundaries, provider-patient communications for a minimum of 6 hours.
And informed consent.
And informed consent within that 6 hours?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me restate that then. It's been moved and seconded to issue a non-disciplinary order for continuing education. The education shall be completed within 6 months. Courses must be pre-approved and may be completed online. They do not count towards renewal requirements. The courses shall be completed in the areas of ethics for a minimum of 3 hours, boundaries, communication, and informed consent for a minimum of 6 hours. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bastille?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Hike?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
That motion passes.
Great. Thank you to everyone who presented. We appreciate you. Appreciate your time here at the board. And the board staff will get with you, Dr. Fearon.
Will that that order be sent to me in some kind of hard document as opposed to my scribble that I wrote down here?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, it will. And thank you, LW. We appreciate you. All right. Thanks, you guys. I think we are finished with agenda items around constituents, and we're at board business and reports. Is that right?
We are.
Great. All right. And the first up is FSDPT.
Yes. And Jeff just, oh, there's Jeff. I saw Jeff's picture move away, and real Jeff is there. I thought he exited.
My apologies. No, I am here.
Perfect.
Let me
Jeff is presenting to the board today on the FSBPT's alternate approval pathway. Take it away, Jeff.
Okay, so let me share. Are you able to see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so basically, and just so you know, while I'm sharing, since I'm at my parents' house, so I'm only on my one monitor, and so I can't see you until I stop sharing. So so if anyone wants to get my attention, just shout out, because I won't see you raise your hand or anything.
Jeff, this
yes.
is Josh Greer. I live at my parents' house, too, so there's no shame in that.
It's just, you know, when you're not in your normal work setup, it really, when you're trying, when you get used to two monitors, to go down
yes.
to one 13-inch laptop is not the easiest.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I was the first person in my office back from COVID for that very reason. It's like, I got three monitors at work. I have my laptop at home. I'm coming to work.
Okay, so, and I know that I think Judy has previously, or even, you know, Karen has, I think, shared information a little bit about what the AAP process is. And I know many of you have attended FSBPT meetings where you've heard presentations about the alternate approval process. But really, I want to give a little bit of high-level background about what AAP is, and then answer any potential questions that the board may have. So what this slide is showing is really that the difference between AAP and the current process that happens is really just who makes the candidate eligible to sit for the exam. So ultimately, the entity that determines if somebody has met all of the requirements to be eligible for a license to practice as a PT or PTA in the state of Arizona, that still remains with the board, you know, all of that stuff. The only change is, instead of, you know, board staff needing to be the entity to actually make somebody eligible to sit for the exam once they've met the requirements in Arizona's laws and rules, the FSBPT system, the second that they have registered to sit for the exam, it would automatically make them eligible, which means that they would get their authorization to test information, in essence, the day after they've registered. And the reason why AAP is only for graduates of CAPD accredited programs is because of the functionality that we have in the exam registration process, where it starts with the program director adding all of the students in the cohort into our system. And then before a student can actually register for the NPTE, the program has to indicate to FSBPT through the online interface that the student is on track to graduate. So that's the sort of graduation validation step that we talk about. So until the school has told FSBPT, this student has met the requirements that we think they are on track to graduate, which can only happen no earlier than 150 days before the graduation date. And obviously under the NPTE policies, nobody can test earlier than 90 days before graduation. But once that step happens, the student can go ahead and register. So in the AAP model, once that student registers, they immediately are made eligible to sit. In the standard pathway model, once they've registered, they go on the jurisdiction's pending eligibility list, and then the state has to indicate that they are eligible to sit, and then the rest of the process is the same. Once they've tested, the scores are sent to the state, and once they've met all of the other requirements, they ultimately will get a license issued by the board. So really, some of the advantages of the alternate approval process is really this idea of it really helps the candidates be able to schedule much faster than they can in the current process. And obviously, it takes, you know, average of, you know, 1.5 to 2 weeks in most non-AAP states to make somebody eligible. That switches to one day after they have switched to AAP. And the reason for that is not because the board itself is not efficient in reviewing and processing the application. It's more because typically all of the application has to be received, reviewed by the board before the student can be made eligible to sit, which means that board staff is waiting for documentation from the school saying this person has met all of the program requirements. There may be other documents that are being weighed on, for example, you know, the criminal background checks. So there are things that are out of the board's control that delays their ability to make them eligible. With AAP, we don't have to worry about have all of the application materials been received and reviewed by the board. All we care about, has the school validated electronically that they are on track to graduate? Has the student registered? And if both are yes, then they get their authorization to test information, which means that they have the ability to go ahead and schedule, which obviously, you know, for certain exam dates, especially in the April and the July testing windows, you know, sometimes Prometric seats at a candidate's preferred testing location can go very fast. So the sooner they can schedule, the better their odds of actually being able to schedule at the Prometric test center that is their number one choice. So obviously there are certain key requirements that a state has to, you know, comply with in order to opt into AAP. So the first is you have to agree to the FSBPT's NPT eligibility requirements. And to the best of my knowledge, Arizona already complies with the NPT eligibility requirement. So the 6-time lifetime limit, you know, no more than 3 attempts in the 12-month period. There are no pending flags, and then there's no too low scores, which basically is a score of less than 400. Some other things that we are able to enforce in AAP, we can enforce it. There are still a handful of states, I don't believe Arizona is one of them, that have lifetime limits that are less than 6 attempts. We can accommodate a lifetime limit that is more restrictive than our NPTE eligibility requirements. We also know that some states will allow somebody who is educated as a PTA to sit for the PT exam, but probably the majority of states do not allow for that. So if Arizona does not let a PTA sit for the PT, let somebody who is educated as a PT to sit for the PTA exam, we can restrict that. So that way, if we know that you went to a PT program under AAP, it would not let you register for the PTA exam if that is a restriction that Arizona has under their laws and rules. And then ultimately, that although for the non-standard testing accommodation request, you know, we'll ask for input from the board. Ultimately, under AAP, FSBPT has the final say on all testing accommodation requests. So the other two things that are not supported under AAP, one are mandatory remediation requirements. And then some states have a combined lifetime limit. So we allow 6 attempts on the PT exam, 6 attempts on the PTA exam. There are some states that say you're allowed 6 attempts total, regardless of what exam level. So we cannot support that kind of restriction under AAP. With testing accommodations, obviously right now, all testing accommodations are reviewed by the board before you would make that person eligible with accommodations. If you were to opt into alternate approval process, FSBPT would be responsible for all of the requests for testing accommodations. So that would apply both to the NPTE and to the Arizona Law Exam, since that is a Prometric administered exam. So we would handle all of the testing accommodation requests. And the testing accommodation request also would apply if you had any non-CAPD applicants that were requesting testing accommodations. It's not common for foreign educated applicants to request testing accommodations, but if Arizona were to opt in, even the non-CAPD applicants, we would review their testing accommodations. So obviously, you would still determine, is their education substantially equivalent before they could sit for the exam, but we would still handle the testing accommodation requests for the foreign educated applicants. So ultimately, the question really is, will you need to amend are you interested in doing this? But then if you are, would you need to amend your laws or rules? And it wasn't clear to me, and I told Judy this, ARS 32-2-24B2C, it was not clear to me if the way that we do the graduation validation process, where the school will go in, electronically validate the students, is on track. It's not clear if that process would meet the requirements of that section. So if the answer is yes, and the board is, and I'm going to stop sharing so I can see people. So if the answer is yes, and the board is interested, then it's a much simpler process. Then it would be, I would send Judy an addendum to your existing NPTE agreement. We execute that, and then we literally just check a box in our online processing system to turn on AAP for Arizona. If it turns out the board is interested, but the feeling was that ARS 32-2-24B2C really will restrict it, then obviously the first step is making a change to that element. And then once that rule, I believe that's a rule change, or is it a statute? I can't remember if it's ARS's rules or statutes.
That's a statute.
Okay. Then, you know, it we'd have to obviously change that. So it's, the bigger questions are, is AAP something that is even of interest to the Arizona board to then have that secondary conversation of, does your existing laws and rules allow you to immediately opt in if you're interested? So that really is my presentation. I really just wanted to be here as a resource. I know Judy said some of the members had some questions that that's why she wanted me to come present to the board so that I could try to answer any of the questions that anyone has.
I had a quick question, Jeff, just back on the ADA accommodation. Was it just the ADA accommodation for foreign trained students that the FSBPT handles under the AAP, or all?
We would handle all, but so making them eligible to sit for the exam only applies to CAPTI accredited students. So your foreign educated applicants still go through the same process you're doing today, where okay. You go on your pending eligibility list, the board determines that their credential evaluation is substantially equivalent, you make them eligible. But for the testing accommodations, that would apply both CAPTI and non-CAPTI applicants.
Thanks for clarifying.
Hey, so Jeff, this is Mindy. I have a question about ADA accommodations. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there was a kind of standard process that your staff would go through for that. But I'm just curious what percent just a ballpark of those that request accommodations are granted accommodations?
Mindy, I'm not probably the best person to answer that because really, Christine Sousa and many of you, you know, Christine, who's our managing director for exam services, she's more responsible for the testing accommodation element of, the AAP process, but I can definitely, you know, have, Christine send an email to Judy that can be shared with the board to try to answer that question.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So Jeff,
go ahead.
I have a question. If the board determines that that they're interested in this process, and if the process is made available swiftly, the question that I would have is, you know, we have a number of applicants now who are in the process of everything. A number of them have registered for the exam. If mine is more of a practical scenario, if the switch is pulled and the eligibility is granted by FSVPT through AAP, does that happen for everybody that's in the pipeline existing right now?
The way it works, Judy, is that it really, anyone who is already on your pending eligibility list, the board would still be responsible for making eligible. And then, like, literally, if I were to say, you know, I get off this call and you say, oh, we're ready to go, and I get off the call at 1:30 today, or 1:30 my time today, and check the box, literally anyone that registers starting at 1:30 today for Arizona would go through AAP. So it doesn't sort of retroactively impact the people that have already registered. It really would only impact the people that register subsequent to us activating AAP for the state.
Thank you. That helps. That helps to clarify.
If we were to opt into this and we accept, could we then just go in and approve the ones that were paid? Or would that be something, you know what I mean? How would we go about doing that?
Monica, I would basically say that from our perspective, whenever a board in our current process determines that somebody should be made eligible, it's the board's decision. So if it was a issue of we turn on AAP and the board basically says, you know what, anyone that has already an open registration, because, you know, if they had registered, you know, a minute from now, they'd be made eligible. We're just going to go and make them all eligible. That is up to the prerogative of the board to do that. So we're not going to say you can't do that, because ultimately it's we're just waiting for when the Arizona board tells us that this person is eligible to sit and they mark them eligible. We just assume whatever standard you're using to make that determination is the standard that the board is using. So if you did that, it would be perfectly fine from our perspective.
Thank you.
So it sounds like one of the things we need to do is make sure that it meets the requirements for our statute. Okay.
Yeah, I would say the two key things are, you know, is the board interested? Because if the board's not interested, then there's no point in trying to determine if, you know, the statute would be a roadblock. But if you come to that first determination, the board is interested, then I think it's making sure that, and, you know, obviously I'm not an expert in your laws and rules. I was just more like the quickly going through. So I may have missed something. Maybe you're going to say that, oh, that's not a roadblock, but there's something else in your laws and rules that would be a roadblock that I may have missed. So I've just, like, my quick review only identified that as the potential roadblock. but there may be others. And obviously, you know, that's why the board has legal counsel to help determine if there are any kind of statutory or regulatory roadblocks that would prevent you from opting in without making any amendments.
Thanks, Jeff. So if the board is interested in pursuing, what would be our next steps? Do we need to, you know, ask the staff to pursue the next steps?
That's typically what other states have done when they've determined that the board was interested. It's usually like, you know, after the board meeting where the board, you know, gave the okay to staff, then I would typically work with, in essence, in this case, Judy, to facilitate, you know, everything happening. So it would be, you know, I'd send Judy the addendum. She probably would have it reviewed by your legal counsel to make sure that there's nothing in it that caused any concerns. We obviously, if there are, you know, we're more than happy to negotiate on coming up with some kind of, you know, agreement that works for both parties. And then once we've executed the agreement, typically what we'll do is we'll have almost like a very brief, like a 15-minute pre-go-live meeting where we really just go over all of the final implementation stuff so that we confirm with Judy. Usually we'll have that with both the director and the key licensing staff to go over, okay, any questions you have, these are the settings we're going to make sure that we know, you know, on the, like the PT sitting for the PTA exam, those kinds of things. So we know how to configure everything. And then we basically say, you tell us when you want us to turn it on. And some states, it's the second we get off that call, they want us to turn it on. Sometimes it's they want to stage it because they say, you know, we want to make some changes to our application forms or some information on our website. So we really want to have a little bit of time to make those changes before we actually ask you to turn it on. So there have been cases where, you know, the board has asked, like, hey, can we wait 3 weeks to turn it on? Because we need that time to make the appropriate changes on our end to get ready for AAP to actually start.
Thank you.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the board, I think one of the things, if the board is interested in, you know, pursuing this pathway, then probably, you know, Judy, Veronica and I need to do a pretty thorough review just to make sure that everything, you know, is, you know, works. And if there are concerns, to do a deeper dive into those areas to see how best to align the two so that the board can go forward. And in the interim, I don't know if this is a possibility, but and Jeff, my name's Mark, and I'm the board's legal advisor. If it's possible, while we do that, to simultaneously perhaps get a copy of the amendment, so that we can, you know, kind of, you know, do multiple things simultaneously.
And I believe Judy has a copy of the addendum.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you.
It's in the board materials.
Sorry, I overlooked that, Judy. Thank you.
No problem.
Because that's probably something that will have to be reviewed by DOA. But we can, you know, talk about that. So that's just some thoughts. Again, if the board is interested, then we would have to look at not only the particular section that Jeff pointed out, but just to make sure that everything aligns. And I know that, you know, Judy and Veronica probably have already, you know, done that to a great extent.
Yeah, I think so. I would just ask if there's anyone, you know, on the board who's not interested, let us know. I think we've had just, you know, lots of things come up and had the opportunities to kind of discuss, which is why we wanted to ask Jeff for more information. That I think we as a board are very interested in streamlining the pathway for our applicants, as well as, you know, aligning with our resources at the FSBPT to help, you know, in the work that we do around ADA accommodations and in that application process. Mm-hmm.
Right, and obviously if subsequent to today's meeting, if anyone has any questions, you know, it's, you know, Judy knows that, you know, she can just, you know, reach out to me and I can try to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Rosa? All righty. Thank you so much for your time, Jeff. We appreciate you.
I'll see some of you in a few months.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, so Judy, it's you.
Just one question. Do we need to do any kind of vote, Mr. Harris, to regarding the board's interest or anything along that those lines?
If you want to memorialize it just to continue to look into the feasibility, sure.
Okay. Is that just a motion or is it a just a – okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Make a motion that we direct the staff to continue to investigate with the FSCPT on the alternative approval pathway to pursue potentially that process for Arizona.
Second. Who seconded?
We all did.
I'll give it to Mr. Hike then. That's the first voice I heard.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want to call the vote, Judy?
Yeah, it's been moved and seconded to direct staff to continue investigating the feasibility of the FSBPP's alternate approval pathway process. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bastia?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Hike?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
That motion passes. Okay, and then on to the next item, which I need to remember what it was.
Financials, I think.
Nope, not quite. I think we've got one.
Oh, board order pre-approval continuing education courses.
There we go. I have something in my way on my screen preventing me from seeing the document. Okay, so this matter is with respect to the terms for board ordered continuing education. Typically, all of those orders or consent agreements have language in them to require pre-approval of the coursework. On occasion, board staff will receive a completion document from a complaint respondent for coursework that was not submitted for pre-approval. Typically, when a respondent submits documentation for coursework, we look in their file to recall what was approved, and every once in a while we come across one that was not. So in that case, we would look at the course itself, we would look at the information about the course, and kind of determine if it would have been pre-approved had it been submitted in that manner. So at this point, based on the fact that they do have a board order that is requiring pre-approval, they did not seek the pre-approval. We're looking to understand how the board would like to direct staff, and the potential options of something like that would be that the staff do what it is doing now in terms of reviewing the course to determine if pre-approval would have been granted if submitted appropriately. And if so, then the respondent is informed that according to the terms of the order, the course should have been submitted for pre-approval. And after review, the course has been found to be acceptable. Moving forward, the respondent is advised to carefully monitor their orders or their consent agreements to ensure compliance with all terms. Conversely, if pre-approval would not have been granted, the respondent's informed and advised that according to the terms of order, future courses need to be pre-approved. Alternately, we could present each separate occurrence of this to the board at a regularly scheduled board meeting or any other options that the board may determine is appropriate. you were provided with an example of one course, coincidentally the same course that was submitted by two different individuals without gathering pre-approval. In these particular cases, looking at the cases themselves, looking at the course, had this course been submitted for pre-approval, it would have been pre-approved. So the board is simply asked to determine how they would best like staff to manage these circumstances.
Yeah, this is, Madam Chair, members of the board, this is a conversation that, you know, Judy and I had periodically. The licensees just don't read the consent agreement or the board order closely enough, and they just go out and take it, and then after the fact come to Judy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she said, what do I do with them? And I, of course, in my infinite wisdom, I said, well, let's seek the wisdom of the board.
Yeah.
Because, you know, technically they are in violation, but do you know, how much discretion do you want to give Judy in essence, you know, and, because first and foremost, we want to make sure that, you know, Judy's not in harm's way in any of this.
Sure.
And so are you asking us to give her authority to kind of ratify the continuing education that was taken so long as it meets the approval of the board? How often does this come up?
This is two cases that happened in the same week, which was odd. Most individuals do seek pre-approval, or at the very least, they, you know, say, well, where's this list of magic courses that I can take, kind of thing. So they do inquire in most cases. Every once in a while, you do come across this. You know, it's not new to May. This is not the first time it's occurred, but this is the first time. And based on the fact that we had, you know, we just had our renewal season. We just had the individuals who finished their continuing education audit. We just had the individuals who were working off of a board order for working on an administratively suspended license or certificate. So they've kind of clustered at this point in that respect.
But are these the first two you've ever had, or is this,
these
are
the first
two a year? Or?
These are the first two that I've seen in this chair. Although I know it's happened before.
Because if we're just talking about two a year, I would just say, let's bring them to the board and we can ratify it. And it would be simple and easy. And then you don't have to be caught in the crossfire of it. Is, hey, you didn't get this approved. You can either take a pre-approved course or you can go ask the board to ratify it. And explain to the board. And I know that's cumbersome, but it's only two cases.
Well, and this, and just for clarification, and I understand where you're going with that, but it's not as though we have a pre-approved list of any courses. Typically the respondent is seeking their own courses, and then they submit that information for us to review in light of their board order or agreement, and we review it. And if I have any questions about that, I'll typically ask Mindy, or I will come to a PT on the board to ask, you know, what does this sound like to you? Do you think this meets it?
And we're talking about cases where they don't do that. They show up saying, I took that class that Greer offered,
mm-hmm.
I want to terminate my probation. I want to do something. I want to prove to you that I've done it. And mm-hmm. you're like, well, you didn't get pre-approval for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, what do you go from there? I mm-hmm. think the licensee's choice is, hey, you can take a pre-approved course. You can count what you took towards your continuing education, but it doesn't count towards your board order. Or you can go to the board and say, hey, I messed up, but I did take this course, and see what the board says. And I just don't know if we need any special rule to deal with something that happens once or twice a year. I'm happy to, if we're talking, if we're getting 15 of them, one, we need to take the language in the board order and make it like 24 font high mm-hmm. so people see it. And then we may need to do something about it. But for one or two, I don't know if we need any special processes.
Yeah. Is it, how much time is it? Is it more time consuming to decide if the one they submitted was meets your requirements, or the one before they take it, or after, and you have to go back and find it and see if it beats it?
It's with respect to looking at the course itself, it's pretty much a wash. I'm either getting the information and corresponding with them ahead of time, or I'm looking at it afterwards. It's, you know, there's a number of them that will submit just the course name or the course providers or something like that. So we typically say, you know, everything's available online right now. So it's like, just, you know, give me a link to the course where I can see the presenter, the course, the objectives, the description, all of that kind of stuff. So it's pretty much doing that same thing. In these cases, it would just be a case of it's not, you know, you didn't submit this to us beforehand. You took the course, you submitted, and typically they'll send their information in, not in a lump sum, but as they complete something, they'll say, hey, I did this, or, you know, hey, I paid my civil penalty, or whatever. So there's generally some dialogue that's going on. Reviewing the course itself, unless it's a really obscure course, is not really changed before or after.
And have we had some that actually didn't meet, like would not have been pre-approved, and so you've denied it?
No, we haven't had that. We haven't had that occur. It's typically in something that's more readily available, like an ethics course or something, that there are so many of them out there. You know, I've had people submit ahead of time that have submitted courses that didn't seem to meet the intent of the board order. And then they're just sent back to say, you know, find something that is more appropriate based on the terms of your order. But no, I've not gotten any of them after the fact that didn't. In that case, I would have simply looked at it and said, well, you didn't have this pre-approved and it doesn't meet requirements anyway. So submit something that does, basically.
Okay. I tend to agree with Josh in that, you know, if they're not following the board order as it's stated or whatever it is, and doing their own thing, that's all fine and well that you took a great course. But again, most likely you are in this situation because you didn't follow the rules. And so just being, you know, it's okay this time, I don't know that that really speaks to what the message we're trying to give is that, you know, you can't cut corners, whether you're practicing or whether you're following a board order or what, you've got to follow the process. And so I think if someone submits a CEU and wants to terminate their probation and it wasn't something you approved, I honestly agree with Josh that they have a choice then. They can either submit something and get it pre-approved or come before the board and plead their case. Would you consider amending, you know, or ratifying my board order or what, that I took this but I didn't follow the rules, you know?
And I realize that asking for this, next month we're going to get 40 of them. And we're going to have 40 of them before the board. And at that point, we're going to be right. We're going to be right back here saying, Judy, we give you approval to fix it. But right now, I don't see the problem.
Okay. Mr. Harris, then in this case, we have two individuals with a course. Are we agendized in a manner that the board could decide what to do with these, or are we bringing them back again next month?
We'll need to bring them back next month.
Yeah, and I think the instruction that you can give them is basically what we just talked about today, is, hey, they can try to get it approved by the board, or ratified, I think, is probably the more appropriate legal term, or they can go and take a compliant course. Get one that's pre-approved.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Thanks for bringing this to our attention. Hopefully we don't get 40 next week, next month.
Yeah, hopefully. Very hopefully.
But there's a point to the process, and I think that's, we believe in the process, and so I want to stick with our process. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And that then brings us to the financials. If anybody's got any questions about the financials.
No. Were we charged for the system update? Like, did we help pay for all the system changes that we're going through as far as the renewal system or the website or anything like that? Did each board have to?
So for the website, no, there were no charges with the website updates because that was all handled in-house. And that was a statewide thing. With the upgrades to the system, yes. I mean, we pay for the current system that we're on now, and we were charged for the Centia system that is being developed. We also received appropriated funds for that kind of overlap because right now we are doing with two systems, basically. So we're paying twice at this point. But our funds were appropriated for that. And then it appears that those funds will be appropriated as this development of the new system for not only us, but for multiple agencies bleeds over into the next fiscal year as well.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see that payment in the 8500 line. The non-capital equipment, it was paid in September. Our current system is paid on a yearly basis as well as then monthly support. The new system will be paid on a yearly basis.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Mm-mm. No, thank you.
And then the final piece of the agenda is the licenses, certificates, and registrations issued in the month of April. Any questions there?
No.
Okay. Any future agenda items?
I have a question for the board. I don't know if this is something that would be added. I had brought it up previously, but I want to make sure I'm going about it the appropriate way. So I'm putting together information based on all the states and how they allow supervision of assistive personnel by PTAs or if they don't allow that. But in order for something like that to potentially be changed in Arizona, it would have to be changed in the statute. Because there's a couple of statutes that actually would outline that. What would be the appropriate method of kind of starting that process? Like, after gathering all the information, do you just go straight to the Senate? Do you bring it to the board? Like how would I appropriately go about that?
That would be something that we would probably encourage you to work with your association to do. The board itself doesn't typically seek statute changes of that manner. It more comes from the association who can then work through the process with the legislatures, with the legislators.
Perfect. Well, I can definitely reach out to them and see if, because I want to make sure that I'm getting all the appropriate information as well to be, potentially do something like that. All right.
I'll just add, as you know, the educators group for all the different programs have looked at that, and I believe that they are in the process of doing just that. So I would start there in terms of the program directors and chairs of PT and PTA programs. They are actively doing that and trying to have the APTA, AZ see that before it came before the board. So just so that you don't have to create the wheel.
And I've actually heard about that.
Oh, can you ask that again?
Am I still echoing? Shoot. Is that coming from my end or
somewhere else? No, hearing.
I think seeing like your report would be very interesting though, even if it wasn't something that we would take action on. Especially if it would then, you know, maybe look at some type of legislative change.
Awesome. Dr. Hyden, I was aware of. Hold on. What's going on?
Karen, you're echoing.
It's me.
Am I good now?
Yes.
Okay. So I had talked with some people who were working on that. I think what you're referring to is they're working to try and get to where students don't fit into the assistive personnel. So what I'm trying to do is actually make it so that PTAs can potentially supervise technicians on site. To improve access to care for patients. So that's something that I haven't found anybody who's worked on that yet. But I'll definitely get with the groups and see if anything like that is something that they've potentially looked into. So right now I'm going through all of the state statutes and trying to see which states allow that, which states don't allow that. And then I want to potentially reach out to those boards and see, like, are there any issues that potentially come up? Because of a PTA supervising a technician, you know, things like that.
Hey, right. It's slightly different, but it's along the same lines. So.
Yeah. So I definitely can get with them and kind of see what they're looking to do and then maybe combine that somehow.
Okay. Thanks, Giovanni.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. Is there any other potential topics or any topics at all for potential future agenda items? Okay. Doesn't sound like it. All right. Well, I appreciate everyone's time. I make a motion that we adjourn.
Second.
Great.
Judy, you
It's been moved and seconded to adjourn. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Hike?
Yes.
Mr. Grib?
Yes.
Y'all voted twice.
Yes.
The meeting is adjourned at 10:50, and we're stopping recording at this.
You guys have a safe Memorial Day weekend. Yeah.